I gave every character a verbal tic. One stuttered, one did malapropisms, one was an Oki versed in Sartre, and the alien parents, my favorite characters, always yelled. A point I reinforced by having at least one word in every sentence they spoke capitalized. While you don't have to be this drastic in your script, that exercise showed me how I could make characters richer, and more fun to read out loud, by the way. I had learned that amping up even the most, "Hi, how are you, I'm fine" kind of dialogue revealed everything about each of my characters and made the read 100% better. Take a step back. I have just been involved in 10 months of rewrites. My partner Sheldon and I were working on our Golden Fleece, and it took seven drafts to get it right. One of the reasons it took so long is that we had made a basic mistake. We had broken the rule of take a step back. Just so you know, it happens to everybody, even the pros. As mentioned in Chapter 4, our story is about a kid who is kicked out of military school and sent home only to find that his parents have moved away without telling him. So, our kid hero goes on the road and has lots of fun adventures where he interacts with people and helps them, because he's a good kid who causes flowers to bloom and changes the lives of strangers wherever he goes. Our mistake was that the way we had created the character, a nice kid who helps others, didn't give him anywhere to go. Our hero had already changed. He didn't need this journey. He was the same person he was at the beginning that he was at the end. And the fixing of that problem, draft by draft, took forever. Each draft was about taking him back a step emotionally so the journey means something. Okay, a little bit further. Okay, let's take him all the way back. It seems easy now. But in the middle of it, we couldn't figure it out. We couldn't see that what we needed to do was take our hero back as far as possible so that the story would be about his growth. And believe it or not, this kind of mistake happens all the time. A lot of us know where our heroes end up and don't want to put them through the torment of growth, so we avoid the pain for them. And just like raising a child, you can't do that. These characters have to grow by getting bumped on the nose, and whether we like it or not, we have to let them. In our case, Sheldon and I liked our heroes so much and wanted him to come out in the end being upbeat, positive, and special, but we didn't want to see his struggle to become that. It was like reading the answers at the back of the book without doing the work on the test questions. We wanted to get there so badly, we didn't see that getting there was the story. And showing the bumps along the way made the payoff greater. Take a step back applies to all your characters. In order to show how everyone grows and changes in the course of your story, you must take them all back to the starting point. Don't get caught up in the end result and deny us the fun of how they get there. We want to see it happen to everyone. This is just one more example of how movies must show the audience everything, all the change, all the growth, all the action of a hero's journey. By taking it all back as far as possible, by drawing the bow back to its very quivering end point, the flight of the arrow is its strongest, longest, and best. The take a step back rule double checks this. If you feel like your story or any of its characters isn't showing us the entire flight, the entire journey, take a step back and show it all to us. We want to see it. A limp and an eye patch. Sometimes in a screenplay, the basics are done. Your hero and bad guy are great. The plot explodes and intensifies after the midpoint, and everybody's got snappy dialogue. Everything's great except for one small problem. There seem to be too many minor characters. It's hard to tell one from another. Readers will confuse that guy with this other guy, and it bugs you. Isn't it obvious? What has happened is that you have not given us a hook to hang our hats on for each of the characters that are vital to your story. And while we often rationalize this by saying, "Oh, well, they'll handle that in casting," I've got one word for you. Ha! You won't see casting if your reader can't see characters. But there's an easy way to solve this. Make sure every character has a limp and an eye patch. Every character has to have a unique way of speaking, but also something memorable that will stick him in the reader's mind. The reader has to have a visual clue, often a running visual reminder, which makes remembering a character easier. A limp and an eye patch may seem like a silly way to think about how to attach traits to characters to make sure we remember them, but it works, if you remember to do it. Often the realization that you need something like this comes from a reader. A great example of a limp and an eye patch happened to me and shows just how amazing this simple device can be. Sheldon and I were writing our ill-fated, really mean girls, We had one character, the lead boy who has a crush on our lead girl and acts as the speaker of truth whenever he is around, keeping the lead girl on the straight and narrow with his moral compass. He's a funny kid, mature beyond his years, the type who will be a sterling adult, but right now is too smart for his own good. He was vital to the plot, but somehow unmemorable on the page. Our manager, Andy Cohen, read draft after draft and kept getting stuck on the boy. Who was he? Yes, he had an important function, but why was he interesting? We tried changing dialogue, making him funnier, smarter, but still got the same note. Finally, Sheldon came up with a brilliant fix. When we meet the boy for the first time, we described him as wearing a black t-shirt and sporting a wispy soul patch on his chin. Emblematically, it fit, showing his yearning to be hip and older on the inside and not quite cutting it in his appearance. And every time he appeared, we referenced this. We gave the script back to Andy, and he called us to say he didn't know what we'd done, but the character of the boy really popped for him now. The boy jumped off the page and registered in his mind. We had done very little overall. He was the same kid. We just gave him a limp and an eye patch. And it made all the difference. Is this technique fake or artifice? No, it's screenwriting. It's the job. So when you find yourself with one or several unidentifiable characters who are getting lost in the shuffle, try saying what I say now all the time. I think this guy needs a limp and an eye patch. Is it primal? I have used the term primal throughout this book. To me, it is my touchstone, both in creating a script and fixing it once it's done. Is it primal is a question I ask from the beginning to the end of a project, and making it more primal is the name of the game. To ask, is it primal, or would a caveman understand, is to ask if you are connecting with the audience at a basic level. Does your plot hinge on primal drives like survival, hunger, sex, protection of loved ones, or fear of death? At the root of anyone's goal in a movie must be something that basic, even if on its surface it seems to be about something else. By making what drives your characters more primal, you'll not only ground everything that happens in principles that connect in a visceral way, you'll also make it easier to sell your story all over the world. Think about it. Everyone in China gets a love story. Everyone in South America understands a Jaws or an alien, because don't get eaten is primal, even without snappy dialogue. But this can also go for little fixes of minor characters or subplots in a script that's not working. Are these characters motivated by primal drives? It's another way of saying, are these characters acting like recognizable human beings? At their core, they must be. Or else, you are not addressing primal issues. Let's say you have a highfalutin concept, stockbrokers rigging the international bond market. Fine. All very interesting. But at its core, no matter what the plot is, by making each character's desire more primal, that plot is grounded in a reality that everyone can understand. Suddenly, it's not about stockbrokers. It's about human beings trying to survive. Here are primal drives and the storylines of a few hit films. The desire to save one's family, Die Hard. The desire to protect one's home, Home Alone. The desire to find a mate, Sleepless in Seattle. The desire to exact revenge, Gladiator. The desire to survive, Titanic. Each of these is about a primal need that might be better seen as a biological need, the prime directive. The desire to win the lottery is in fact the desire to have more food, more wives, make more children, to be able to reproduce at will. The desire for revenge is, in fact, the desire to knock off a competing DNA carrier and propel your own DNA forward. The desire to find one's parent or child is the desire to shore up and defend existing DNA and survive. You may think your story is about something more sophisticated than this. It's not. At its core, it must be about something that resonates at a caveman level. Altogether now, when in doubt, ask, is it primal? Summary. So now you've seen how you can double-check your work using simple rules of the road. If your script feels flat or if you get back comments from readers who can't quite put their finger on it, but know something's wrong, here are 7 easy thought starters to help you find the weak spot and fix it. Ask yourself these questions, the is it broken test. 1. Does my hero lead the action? Is he proactive at every stage of the game and fired up by a desire or a goal? 2. Do my characters talk the plot? Am I saying things a novelist would say through my characters instead of letting it be seen in the action of my screenplay? 3. Is the bad guy bad enough? Does he offer my hero the right kind of challenge? Do they both belong in this movie? 4. Does my plot move faster and grow more intense after the midpoint? Is more revealed about the hero and the bad guy as we come into the Act 3 finale? 5. Is my script one note emotionally? Is it all drama, all comedy, all sadness, all frustration? Does it feel like it needs, but does not offer, emotion breaks? 6. Is my dialogue flat? After doing the bad dialogue test, does it seem like everyone talks the same? Can I tell one character from another just by how he or she speaks? 7. Do my minor characters stand out from each other, and are they easy to differentiate by how they look in the mind's eye? Is each unique in speech, look, and manner? 8. Does the hero's journey start as far back as it can go? Am I seeing the entire length of the emotional growth of the hero in this story? 9. Is it primal? Are my characters at their core reaching out for a primal desire? To be loved, to survive, to protect family, to exact revenge? If you are having any nagging doubts about any of the above, you now know what to do. You have the tools to go back in and fix it. But will you? That's the rub. Here's a tip. When in doubt, do it. Odds are that if you or your initial batch of readers have found problems with your screenplay, everyone else will too. Don't be lazy. Don't say, oh well, no one will notice, because they will. It is better to be brilliant now and have the guts to fix your mistakes before your script's sitting on Steven Spielberg's desk. You only get the one shot at a first impression. Try to get over the love affair you have with yourself and your work. God knows I've been in love with my own 1,000 times, and do what needs to be done. This is what separates the pros from the wannabes, that nagging voice that says, it sucks, and the mature adult professional voice that quickly chimes in, and I know how to fix it. Exercises. 1. Go back over your list of movies in your favorite genre, pick one that feels weak, and use the Is It Broken test to see if it can be improved. 2. Take another of your favorite movies from your genre and examine the hero-bad guy relationship. Imagine torquing this relationship out of whack by making the bad guy less powerful or ordinary. Does this simple change make the hero less interesting, too? 3. Try talking the plot in real life. Seriously, go to a party or meet with a group of friends and say, I sure am glad I'm a screenwriter who was born in Chicago, or, gosh, you've been my friend for 20 years ever since we met in high school. See what reaction you get to this kind of dialogue. Chapter 8. Final Fade-In. And so we come to the end of our screenwriting confab. We've discussed many relevant topics, and while I've been writing this book and working on screenplays of my own, thank you very much, a lot has happened out here in Hollywood land. Sequels have met with mixed success. Many pre-sold franchises did well, but some died miserable deaths. The open huge in the first week strategy, 3,000 plus theaters, even if you drop 70 to 80% in the second week of a film's release, still recouped a majority of most films' budgets, assuring this tactic will continue. And family films outperformed every other type of movie, a truism that was met with the resounding sound of crickets by the Xenia-suited slicksters. It's hard to be cool at the cocktail party when you make, PG flicks. In short, it's more than interesting. It's a boom time, a gold rush. And the most important thing for you to know is that it's still a highly profitable business with lots of reason to invest in new talent. So here's the good news and bad news as it relates to your spec screenplay. The good news is the studios have money to buy your script. And the lack of stellar success in the pre-sold franchise arena should indicate they need you. More than ever, they must have original ideas. So buying your spec makes sense. The bad news is they attribute all their success to themselves. Shrewder marketing, better accounting, more control over how ideas get turned into movies. That's how they did it, ladies and gentlemen. God love them, studio executives kept praying for the sun to rise, and each dawn assume it was their prayers that made it happen. But this should not deter you. If you have gotten anything out of this book, it's that selling a script has a lot more to do with thinking of your screenplay as a business plan than ever before. If you have a creative approach, you too can sell to Hollywood. And if you do, you have a bright future. A catchy log line and a killer title will get you noticed. A well-structured screenplay will keep you in the game, and knowing how to fix your script and any other script you may be presented with will get you a career. If you have mastered the demands of the job as outlined in this book, you will win this game. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. How, you may ask, do you even get in the door? Ambition versus fate. Before the first class is over, invariably, I will be asked the one burning question on every screenwriter's mind. How do I get an agent? Would you believe me if I told you that it's all luck? Would you call me crazy if I advised you not to worry about it, that it will happen when it happens? Probably not. But that may be because I am very comfortable with the subject of how to sell myself. I personally love the business of marketing my scripts, and me. I am not afraid to pick up the phone, meet someone at a party, and actually call them the next day, if they give me their card, or finagle friends to get me introductions to people I think would like to meet me. I think I have something to offer. I like the business, and I like meeting the people in it. And the worst thing that can happen, I figure, is that someone will say no. So here are two stories about how I got my first agents. One is a demonstration of ambition, one an example of fate. I got my first agent by sheer pluck. My friends and I had written and produced a TV pilot called The Blank Show, a funny parody of what was then the brand new phenomenon of cable TV. We had made it on a shoestring, and once we were done with it, we didn't know what to do. I volunteered to market it myself. I came to Los Angeles, submitted it to Public Access TV, and got a commitment for a day and time it would air. Then, for weeks, I plastered the West Side, where I assumed producers lived, with flyers telling the day and time our show would be on. It finally ran one Sunday night, and sure enough, the next day, Monday morning, I got a call from the producing partner of Bud Friedman, owner of the Improv. He loved our show. Would my friends and I be interested in being represented? I arranged to have my gang of cohorts come to Los Angeles for a meeting with Bud, who offered to manage us there and then. A little luck and ambition had gotten us noticed. And while our comedy troupe eventually broke up, I have maintained my friendship with Bud Friedman to this day. That's what working it can do. So you should always be working it. But here's where fate is better. My next agent, and the best one I ever had, I met through circumstances that were much more serendipitous. On a break from my duties as a production assistant for a sitcom called Teachers Only at NBC, I decided to go home to Santa Barbara for the weekend. And even though I was tired from the drive, I was restless. I decided to go to a local club to get a drink and hopefully meet girls, and I did. I met a girl I was smitten with on site and who eventually became my girlfriend. No, she wasn't an agent, but her best friend wanted to be one. I hit it off with her, too, and when she was promoted to agent at Writers and Artists, I was one of the first people she asked to be her client. I immediately said yes. And that's how I came to be represented by Hillary Wayne, all because I stopped in to have a drink at a bar. Hillary and I went on to have a fabulous relationship. She was the best agent I ever had. She made great deals for me, understood my writing and my ability to conceptualize, and she formed the foundation of my entire career. Though she herself was new to the game, she had a real knack not just for selling, but also for positioning both script and writer in the marketplace. Hillary knew how to build careers, and she built mine from scratch. Our relationship coincided with that point in Hollywood history when the spec sale was king. This was a time when studio heads would knock themselves out to take a virgin script away from another studio. They'd bid the price up into the millions to do so. And Hillary was a master at setting up these grudge matches, pitting executive against executive and engineering sales that became the headline on next day's front page of Variety. What I had found in Hillary was not just an agent, but a partner. What made it work was that we were on the same wavelength. We were both hungry to succeed and went out of our way to respect the marketplace and deliver to it what we thought it needed. We read the tea leaves. I went back and made product, and she sold the product. And we made millions of dollars doing it. Hillary passed away in 1998, or I would still be working with her. And I often wonder what she would make of the business today. The landscape has changed, and the spec sale fever is no longer what it was, but Hollywood still needs good ideas and good writers. No matter how you find your way in this maze, you must be bold, and you must find your own Hillary Wayne, because you can't do it alone. It's one thing for me to tell you my tales. It's another to ask what I would do if I were starting out again, or if I wanted to find new representation and sell myself from scratch today. I am lucky. I don't mind getting out from behind my computer and meeting people. Not every one of you is like that. As writers, we tend to be insular, introverted, and introspective. But if you want to sell your script, you have to sell yourself. And I say this in the most healthy and positive sense. There is no crass salesmanship involved if you are genuinely interested in your subject. And if you seek out people to be partners in this game, whom you can help as much as they can help you, then it's mutually beneficial. That's always been my attitude anyway. So maybe I can plant a few positive visualizations in your brain, and you can see yourself following through on a few of them. Because being a talented screenwriter and writing even the most perfect script is only a small part of what will be needed to get you where you want to go. You will need to get out of your workroom and mingle. You'll have to put on a clean shirt and shine your shoes and smile. Preparing the field. Like any well-plotted story with a hopefully happy ending, you must make a plan and follow it, step by step. Here's what you've got. You've got you, a screenwriter with X number of scripts to your credit, varying degrees of success in selling them, and a great big crush on movies and movie makers. You've got your product, your best screenplay, and several pitches, even if they're for screenplays you've already written. And if you follow the advice of Chapter 1, your log lines and titles are killer and ready to go. You've even got a rough idea of what you need next. An agent who will help you sell these projects, and producers who will either buy them from you or go into partnership with you to get these projects set up, sold, and made into movies. If you don't have that list, start making one. Go on the internet and check out the Hollywood Creative Directory, www.hcdonline.com. If you feel like shelling out $50 or so, get a copy. You should. Read that thing and get to know it. Production companies, contact names, fellow writers and producers with projects in your genre is the place to start. Likewise, pick up a copy of the HCD Talent Agency Directory and make a similar list. Include agents at big agencies and small who like the same movies you like. And now you must start being really clever. That soul-eating first contact. You can contact anyone by letter. You can camp out on doorsteps and stalk your victims. You can produce the blank show and get it on LA Public Access and wait for the phone to ring. But whatever your method, slowly and surely, you must introduce you and your product to them. In my opinion, making it about you first is the key. Making it personal, letting them meet and know you is the best way to make the introduction to your work. My genius agent Hillary always said, and it should be on a plaque in the Hall of Fame, every sale has a story. The story is you. But how are you going to get that story told to the people on your list? Well, in person is better than a phone call. A phone call is better than a query letter. A query letter is better than an email. And an email from a stranger is usually when I push delete on my computer, unless I've been forewarned that it's coming or it can do something for me today. The key to all of this is not to think so much about your immediate goals, but your long-term ones. Sure, you need an agent, right now. But you also need to build a reputation. If you are lucky enough to have a career, you will be bumping into these people again and again for years. So try not to burn any bridges, or at least try not to burn them all the way down. Be nice, be considerate, be helpful, be upbeat, but keep knocking on doors and showing your face. Try to put yourself in the shoes of everyone you speak to. What is it that they want? How can you make dealing with you easier on them? And what are they going to get out of the interaction that will make meeting you worth their time? One of the golden rules is it's easier to get an agent when you have a deal that needs closing. And it's also easier to pitch you if someone has already bought something from you. This is why I always recommend that if any legitimate entity wants to option your screenplay, even for little money, and no one else has offered you anything, grab it. I can't tell you the value of having someone go first. And having projects in process, no matter how minor in terms of money up front, tells others you don't have the plague. It also gives you something to talk about when you meet new people. So now you know what you're selling and whom you want to sell to. But how can you make your proposal different? How can you catch the eye of someone who gets proposals all the time? Would you blanch if I told you it was just a matter of turning the crank again and again until something happens? Because that's all it takes. Just keep turning the crank. Any inroad, anyone at all, is a gigantic leap forward. And while you may not get an agent right away or make a sale right away, you are making progress every time you write a query letter, pick up the phone, or meet someone for coffee. Here are a few signs that you are making progress in marketing you. An agent or producer says your project is not for him, but to keep him in mind for future scripts. You talk to an agent or producer that you like. This is a sign, fellow pilgrims. It is just as important for you to feel chemistry with him as his feeling chemistry with you. You've identified someone you will want to get in touch with again, even if it's no now. You have whittled a list of 50 possibles down to 3 maybes. Those 47 no's had to be gotten through. Every no is one step closer to a yes. But by God, you did the work. The yes is that much nearer. You get a referral. Everyone you contact must be asked this question at some point in the process of saying no. Is there anyone else you can recommend that I contact about my career? Referrals are gold, and everyone I know is thrilled to oblige with one. Believe it or not, people want to help you succeed. This is how I got hired as a page at NBC. I cold called a producer for a job. I met with him. He had nothing for me, but the meeting went so well, he called his friend at NBC and got me an interview. The producer had been a page himself. Networking. When the agent and producer route has been thoroughly sifted through, where else can you go to get help? It is who you know, damn it. So how are you going to reach out? Well, these things can be done even without an agent. Film festivals. There's one in your town or somewhere close enough to attend. Go there, get business cards, pitch your script, hear other pitches. A contact is a contact, and every person you meet knows 30 other people. Keep in touch post-festival and ask for referrals. Figure out how you can return the favor. Ask how you can help with their projects. Classes. Go where other screenwriters go, but also go where aspiring producers go. Near me at UCLA, there's a producer seminar every semester. What a great place for a writer to go to meet the next wave of young hotshot producers in town. The local university in your town probably has similar courses. Screenwriting groups. There are lots of these online as well as in local communities, and I belong to one of the best, a savvy little bunch of scribblers called the Screenplayers, www.screenplayers.net. These are bands of screenwriters pooling their resources to help themselves and each other. If the group is set up right, one of you will be a comedy maven, another a devotee of horror, etc. Maybe one knows a producer who can't help him, but can help you. If you don't know of any groups, check out the net or start one yourself. Become an expert. You like movies so much? Well, start reviewing movies. Do it in your local paper or online. The career of director-writer Rod Lurie started in this way. Likewise, François Truffaut. At some point, someone realized these two guys knew what they were talking about and gave them a chance to make their own films. By becoming critics, they had a platform from which to be heard. And when the time came to put their money where their mouths were, they were ready with their own scripts and projects. Come to Los Angeles. Whether you come out for a week or a lifetime, L.A. is where the business is. So what are you doing living in Dubuque? If I were starting all over again, I would come to L.A. and get any job, preferably one as a script reader. I would read as many scripts and make as many contacts as I could while keeping my screenwriting going on the side. If I could only come out for a week, I would be available for as many meetings as possible with producers, industry get-togethers at SAG, DGA, WGA, and be ready with my bio, business card, sample scripts, treatments, and photos so they remember my face. What's stopping you? You.com. Though I have not tried this route, not yet anyway, how about starting a website all about you and your career? Put up your photo and bio. List scripts in progress, treatments and sample pages that are available to download, and even details of deals in progress with referrals to those you're in business with their permission, of course. You.com is a great thing to reference and put on a business card. You want to know who I am? Check out my website. Don't try this at home. Knowing what to do is as important as knowing what not to do. Here are a few things that people advise that I think are less beneficial. Remember, the key ingredient in marketing yourself is to meet people face-to-face if possible. So the following seem like busy work to me. Screenplay contests. This is something I'm going to get skewered for, but I just have to say it. I think screenwriting contests are a colossal waste of time. It's a trend that's been springing up of late, and many writers live and die by the results, waiting by the phone or the mailbox to see if they made it to the top 10% tier, whatever that is. I have one word for such activity. Stop. It means just about zero to any agent or producer with anything real going on. It's nice if you like contests. To me, it's an echo chamber. Do they give you any money for these contests? Are they going to make your film with an A-list cast? No. I haven't seen one script from one contest get turned into a Tom Cruise movie, have you? And we are here to sell our scripts to the likes of box office stars like him. Are we together on this? Good. On the other hand, there are some contests that sponsor panels of experts who have actually sold to or work for the majors. These professionals can offer invaluable learning and networking opportunities. So, if you must enter a contest, you have a job to do first. Read carefully. Ask questions. Seek out the legitimate, the ones with high-level pros who will be available at panels and/or seminars. If they're not associated with the contest, you shouldn't be either. Stupid screenwriter tricks. However clever we think we are, sometimes we go too far in our enthusiasm. We are creative people and think everyone will get it. Well, they don't. Stunts don't work. Lame attempts to get attention don't work. Here are some other don'ts. Don't package yourself in a big crate and mail yourself to William Morris. Don't take out a full-page advertisement in Variety with your picture and phone number with the slogan, "We'll write for food." Don't have your picture taken with a cutout photo of your favorite movie star and send to him autographed with the phrase, "We should be in business together." And whatever you do, don't threaten to leap off the Hollywood sign as leverage to get someone to read your screenplay. It's been done, babe. It's been done. Some marketing hits and misses. I would be remiss in my advice on how to sell yourself and your screenplay if I didn't give you examples of things that I've done, some worked and some didn't, to get my screenplays sold. I have tried it all. Take these for what they're worth and try them at your peril. In the area of specialty pitches, I can tell you some good stories, including doing so well in one meeting with my longtime friend and co-writer, the fabulously funny Tracy Jackson, that producer David Permit flew us to New York the next day to pitch our idea to Howard Stern. You hear of these amazing presentations. Some producers and writers are better at it and more successful than others, and they're certainly fun to know about. One of the best at it is producer David Kirshner, Chucky, An American Tale. David has made it his personal specialty to be able to line up pitch meetings at the top studios and really put on a show. When David had the rights to the 50s TV series Leave It to Beaver and went into Universal to pitch the movie, he brought a surprise guest. During David's pitch, there was a knock on the door and Barbara Billingsley, the original Mrs. Cleaver, came in to serve executives milk and cookies. David took his pitch to exactly one studio. Deal. For his pitch to Disney to sell the Bette Midler movie Hocus Pocus, David created a spooky effects-laden coven complete with actresses dressed as witches to enhance the mood. In this atmosphere, David wove his own selling spell. By the time he was done, the Disney execs were bewitched. Deal. Maybe the king of the logline working today, the man with 1,000 pitches at his command, is producer Bob Cosberg. Bob makes a sale or two every month. He's amazing. Working with writers on ideas of his own and theirs, too, he can conceptualize better than anyone in the business and can weed out the clunkers from the winners with lightning speed. Every time he walks into the room, he has a new one to pitch. Deal. I, too, have done specialty pitches. The one I remember most was a hilarious failure. My first partner, Howard Berkins, and I had a movie idea called Big Girl on Campus, which was basically Tootsie Goes to College. Howard volunteered to do the pitch dressed as a woman in full makeup and outfit, just to get the idea across that it was possible. And as great as Howard looks in a dress, we did not sell BGOC. No deal. Howard did, however, get asked out at Disney. I've had success with specialty marketing. During the spec sale frenzy of the early 90s, the buzz surrounding any virgin screenplay that was on the block for sale was huge. Word that a new script was going out to the town started days and weeks beforehand. The script was tracked by development execs, and their bosses often yelled and screamed, demanding to be put on the list. In this atmosphere, making your script sale special became a fad. For the sale of a script called Ticking Man, ticking clocks with alarms all set to the same time were sent out to executives prior to getting the script. The alarms went off all over town at the moment messengers arrived with the script. Talk about building and paying off tension. When Jim Hagen and I were ready to send out our spec script, Nuclear Family, we decided to package it in artistically designed radioactive script containment units, into which we stuck the script as our way of setting the mood. We made 20 of these from materials we bought at an Army surplus store. Only the most special producers were on the list to get one. After clearing this special delivery with a security gate at every studio, these things looked so much like a bomb we didn't want any false red alerts. The send-out was coordinated by our agent, Hillary, as messengers delivered our script containment units in a flurry of activity all over town. By the time the day was over, Jeffrey Katzenberg at Disney and Steven Spielberg at Amblin had personally gotten on the phone to make a bid. A year or so later, Colby Carr and I stuffed several dozen kids' backpacks with $1 million in play money for Hillary to send out blank check. Basically, the storyline of the script in a finally made 3D souvenir. Each of these specialty presentations resulted in $1 million sale, and headlines and Variety the next day noted the marketing innovations and the bidding war both inspired. For our part, we always devised these because we were genuinely enthusiastic about our script and wanted to get the reader in the mood, just like a good marketing campaign gets a nationwide audience in the mood to see a summer blockbuster. It's a truism that the easiest people to sell are salesmen. I am a sucker for a great campaign of any kind, and so are the executives in Hollywood. They like a good show as much as the next person, and are more likely to applaud the effort. Besides, we had a ball doing it. Of course, this kind of marketing is old hat now. No one does these little tricks anymore. It's doubtful this type of selling will come back. Too many scripts that were bought did not get made, and the spec script craze has died. Studios nowadays don't like to be that out of control when it comes to bidding on scripts, so they don't get into bidding wars as often or as eagerly as they used to. But it was fun while it lasted. Who knows what the next innovative tactic will be? Via the internet, maybe? To get the attention that will set your script apart in the crowd. After all, this is a business that still likes special effects, surprise, and showmanship. It is what it is. Okay, last words on the entire subject. I am a little teary about ending this book. It's been fun to write, and I hope that in some way it's been helpful to you. I have been honored to be a part of this business from the time I was a very little kid. I've had great adventures, lots of truly creative moments, and met some of the most amazing people. It's been a great ride. I've also been faced with terrible self-doubt and self-recrimination. You get bumped in this business and want to throw in the towel from time to time. But if it's in your blood like it's in mine, you learn to persevere. And you get as much education from failure as success. If you keep trying and stay focused, you can have any prize in the firmament. All you have to do is keep working at it. Have a great attitude. And know that today just might be the day. Right before Colby Carr and I ever sent a script out, gave it to our agent or to the producer, we had a little saying to take the sting away. We knew that we had done our best. With Colby, as with all my writing partners, we work hard for the money, and we are harder on ourselves than any critic could possibly be. Just before we dropped that script in the mail or surrendered it to the messenger, Colby and I would say, "It is what it is." That phrase means that certain artistic projects, when combined with the need for those projects to make a profit, are penned in by demands that you must meet. If you meet them satisfactorily, if you've done your job, if you've covered yourself from every angle, if you've met every criteria and done so creatively, that's all you can do. You've done your best. The rest is fate. It is what it is. The business is what it is, too. And while I often rebel against it or try to bullhead my way past it, there's no way around it. They, meaning the people who run the studios and make the decisions, do all kinds of things that drive creative people like us mad. But they are in charge. Yes, they buy into someone's heat and ignore others more talented who are unknown. They often don't read scripts thoroughly. And they are more interested in the headline and the opportunity you represent than your growth as an artist. But that's the nature of business. It is what it is. You must find a life within the confines of it is what it is. This is where your skills as a bullhead will save both you and your sanity. And while I've made fun of this trait throughout this book, I do it as a means of challenging you to be more so. Whatever you do, don't stop being a bullhead. The powers that be can take away a lot of things. They can buy your script and fire you, or rewrite it into oblivion. But they can't take away your ability to get up off the mat and come back swinging, better and smarter than you were before. Most of all, you must try to find the fun in everything you write, because having fun lets you know you're on the right track, so that when you write those two dazzling words, fade in, the 100th time, you're as excited as you were when you wrote them the first. Glossary. Frequent terms in use in the 310 area code. Arc. This denotes the changes a character experiences as tracked from the beginning through the middle to the end of a screenplay. Most often heard in development meetings as in, what's the arc of the hero, and are these characters arcing enough? To which you think to yourself, what is the arc of my patience to sit here and listen to this? At the end of the day. A phrase used by agents and managers to indicate they are about to give you bad news, i.e., we love your script and think it would be great for Julia, but at the end of the day, does she really need to do a musical set of the Middle Ages? Also, when you're most likely to be called by said agent or manager with this bad news. Black holes. These are the spots in your beat sheet, step out line, or places on the board that you have no idea how to fill with story. Looking at black holes will cause you to wonder how you got into the business. You could have gone to law school or joined the army, but no, you had to do this. Block comedy. A low-budget, domestically-oriented family film. It is so low-tech and requires so few company moves you can shoot it on the backlot, as they did with The Burbs. I first heard this term at Disney when we were discussing a script we had sold to them called Poker Night, and it all takes place on the block. We want more of these, said the executive in charge. You know, a block comedy. I'd never heard the term before. It may just be his term, but I like it, and now it's mine. Board. The. A corkboard, blackboard, or artist's notebook that divides a screenplay in progress into four equal parts. Act 1, the first half of Act 2, the second half of Act 2, and Act 3. It is the workout space where, using index cards, pushpins, colored pentels, etc., you can try your best ideas and see what they look like, and then begin to winnow them down. If done right, you'll end up with 40 scenes that make a movie, all laid out neatly on the board in your office or workroom, along with blood, sweat, and tears. Breaking the fourth wall. A filmmaker's inside joke that makes the audience realize they are watching a film. The fourth wall is an invisible one that allows the audience to look into the lives of characters on stage, and breaking it lets the characters essentially look back. This takes you out of the story. Sometimes it works, as when Woody Allen speaks to the audience in Annie Hall, but most times it does not, as when Robin Williams breaks character, like in Aladdin. Booster rocket. There are spots in any screenplay that are potentially dull stretches. Usually, these are found right after big moments, like after the Act 1 break, and sections where the action is petering out, like at the end of Act 2. This is the time to stick in a booster rocket to get us past these spots. John Candy in Home Alone is the classic example. The tale of a mom, Catherine O'Hara, getting home to her child is starting to drag around the end of Act 2. So when John Candy and his polka band cohorts show up, it's just what the script doctor ordered. Another booster rocket character is the manicurist in Legally Blonde. She arrives just when we're growing weary of Elwood's law school saga, just after the break into Act 2 of that screenplay. Both these characters rocket us past these potential slow spots. Callbacks. Bits, images, character traits, and metaphors that are set up in Act 1 and then recalled later in the movie. Often the callback explains what that obvious setup was about. In Back to the Future, the flyer upon which Marty McFly's girlfriend writes, I love you, reminds Marty of the clock tower and the electric storm in 1955 that he needs to power his DeLorean back to 1985. This is a nice callback. Other callbacks are less plot-oriented and remind us of a character's growth, hearkening the past to show change or to re-emphasize a joke by reminding us of its origins. credit jumper. You have sold your script to the studio. Then after your contracted rewrite, you are fired. And when the movie goes into production and you are sent drafts of the rewritten version of your script, you are suddenly appalled to find that it's been altered, often in stupid ways. Your hero Bob is now named Carl. Instead of a Pontiac, he drives a Buick. Congratulations, you've been victimized by a credit jumper, a guy or gal who is gunning for writing credit on your movie and thinks by making these tweaks, it will become his or her own. This is why we have WGA credit arbitration committees to decide who did what. The advantage of writing on spec and being the originator now becomes clear. You have more rights than the average credit jumper. It's up to you to say why specifically this is still your script, and you must. Isn't Hollywood a great town? Exposition. Give me the facts, ma'am, just the facts, but please do it in a way that won't put me to sleep. Thus, exposition, like annoying plot details, heist plans, and backstories, can't be just laid out. It must be entertainingly told by crafty screenwriters. To bury said exposition is to deal with it in a way that is not deadly dull. The masters of the craft make these irritating facts and figures go down as easily as a spoonful of Mapo. First reel. During the era of silent films, film reels were 10 minutes long. Thus, the end of the first reel was 10 minutes into the movie. Flash forward to Joel Silver, genius producer of such action movies as Die Hard and Matrix, who wisely suggests that you have a whammy or a big action set piece at the end of every reel. The first reel still denotes the first 10 minutes of a movie, and I suggest it be used to introduce every A-story character. Four-quadrant picture. The Big Magilla, the whole ball of wax, the mother load. Audience-wise, if you have a four-quadrant hit, you have won the lottery. The four quadrants are men over 25, men under 25, women over 25, and women under 25. If you can draw audience from all those quadrants, you are guaranteeing yourself a hit. Why isn't every movie a four-quadrant movie? Everyone targets different groups for different reasons. As I write today, the single most desirable group is men under 25. Most movies are geared to them because they go with or without their girlfriends. They are more likely to bring others to their movies than they are likely to be brought to other movies. They are the leading indicators of who goes. This may change, but it explains the movie selections at the mall on any given weekend. Have a complaint no one's making movies for you? That's why. But for the spec screenwriters of the world trying to make a sale, this is invaluable information. Genre. After we get past the main headings of, say, comedy and drama, genre breaks down into more specific groupings. If it's a comedy, then what type of comedy is it? Is it a family film, romantic comedy, spoof, or teen comedy? If it's a drama, is it an action, romance, thriller, or horror movie? Each of these is a genre that has its own rules, history, and expectations from an audience. And though the fusion of different genres is now de rigueur in short attention span Hollywood, Ron Howard's The Missing is a gothic western, I suggest one genre per movie, please. Any more, and I personally don't know what it is, or why I go see it. High concept. No one knows exactly how to explain this unwieldy term. I know, I've asked. What is high about a high concept? The term is fuzzy regarding what it's trying to describe. Also, I've asked about the exact place and time this phrase was coined and have come up short. That said, we know what it means. Die Hard is a high concept movie. English Patient is not. Miss Congeniality is a high concept movie. Under the Tuscan Sun is not. Mostly you can divide it into American, high concept, and European, non-high concept, which also explains why American movies do well and European movies do not. Well, everywhere but Europe. I advise you to write as high a high concept movie as you can the first time out, and if you know of the exact terminology or origin of the term high concept, email me. I'll be in Europe. Hook. Ah, le hook. This is the encapsulation of a movie, be it displayed on the poster or in the logline, which grabs your attention and makes you want to run, not walk, to the theater. And when mentioned in Variety, it is the thing that makes you hit yourself on the head and say, why didn't I think of that? Like Proust's Madeleine, the hook must blossom in your mind with possibility and hook you into wanting more. Thus the name. It is a simple mental picture that promises fun and gives you enough of a peek into the storyline that you can see the potential. A good hook is gold for this reason. It works on anyone who hears it, be it agent, producer, studio head, or ticket buyer. A good hook answers, what is it? Inactive hero. What lays there like a lox on a plate? Who can't be bothered to get up out of his chair and go answer the door? Why, the inactive hero, of course. And since the very definition of a hero is to be proactive, the inactive kind must not be a very good thing. Heroes seek, strive, and reach for the stars. They don't wait for the phone to ring. So if your hero is inactive, tell him to get off the dime. In play. When we say that someone is in play, we mean that they have so much heat and are so desirable that the news they are looking for new representation makes the town jump up and down with hysteric joy. For actors who want to leave their agents, for directors and producers who have eschewed their studios when their on-the-lot deal ends and are looking for a new home, being in play means lots of buzz, money, and attention is about to be paid. If you are a screenwriter, this term does not apply to you. While you may very well be in play, to the town it just means you are available. Logline or one line. A logline is the one or two sentence description of your movie that tells us what it is. It must contain a type of hero, that means a type of person, plus an adjective that describes him, the antagonist, ditto, and the hero's primal goal. It must have irony, and it must bloom in our brains with potential. A good logline is the coin of the realm in Hollywood and can be traded like currency with those who appreciate it. Major turns. The break into Act 2, the midpoint, and the break into Act 3 are the major turns of the script. These are conveniently found at the end of each horizontal row on the board. These are also the places that need to be paid the most attention. In a pitch, you will hang your hat on these major turns, and if you're lucky, executives will remember one of them. But you must always have them nailed before you pitch and before you can beat out a screenplay. One sheet. This is the old-timer's phrase for the poster. I have no idea where this term originated, only that it has to do with printing size. A one-sheet is the broadsheet that shows the stars, title, and tone of the film. A good one is gold. One-sheets sell DVDs in the aftermarket, too. On the nose, a.k.a. a little too on the nose. This is one of my favorite development executive phrases, uttered when a suggestion is obvious, unfunny, or something we've seen before. Instead of saying, that's obvious, unfunny, or something we've seen before, they say, it feels a little on the nose. You, who have been up all night trying not to be on the nose, now think of this as a target suggestion. Page one. It's a page one. This is the despairing cry of the development executive who has been handed a script with a good idea and maybe some good characters and little else. It means that some poor schmuck will be assigned to give this a page one rewrite. It is the equivalent of an auto body repairman telling the owner of a damaged car, it's totaled. Pre-sold franchise. When a book, comic book, cartoon, or old TV series has a built-in group of fans, it is considered to be a pre-sold franchise. It presumes that a certain number of people are already sold on the property and will turn up to see it when the movie comes out. This is not always the case. Just ask the producers of The Avengers and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Still, having any group of potential ticket buyers aware of your movie before you go into production is a head start. Even obscure beginnings like the comic book that spawned Men in Black got started from the belief that even a small fan base will get buzz started with moviegoers. But a pre-sold franchise is also something a spec screenwriter is not likely to own. That should not stop you from creating your own franchises. And I encourage you to create the biggest franchise possible. Primal. What is basic about a story, a character's goal, or a movie premise is its relation to our inner drives as human beings. Stories of survival, sex, hunger, and revenge connote immediate interest on our part. We will stop and look when these themes are presented to us. We can't help it. We have to look. It's primal. To you, the screenwriter, this means you must ground every action and story in its primalness. When characters are not acting like human beings, when they are not being driven primally, odds are you are testing the patience of the audience. To ask, is it primal, is to ask, is this relevant to a caveman? The answer must be yes. Promise of the premise. The premise of the movie, it's what is it, can only be proven to be satisfying when we see it in action. What is fun, catchy, or hooks our interest about a movie's poster must be paid off once we get inside the theater. If it is not paid off, we, the audience, will consider it to be a bad experience. We will feel cheated. The promise of the premise are those scenes or scene sequences that exploit the premise to its maximum and are usually found in the fun and games section, pages 30 to 55 of a screenplay. This is the point where we understand fully what this movie is about. This is why we bought our tickets. Residuals. Lovely lime green envelopes come through the mail to the homes of lucky screenwriters on a quarterly basis. We know it's inside. Money. That explains the desire to get a movie made. For it's every appearance on TV, every VHS or DVD sale, every foreign manifestation will be tracked by the WGA residual department and result in more residuals. And the amounts are nothing to sneeze at. I have earned over $100,000 in residuals in my career for two movies. And the checks haven't stopped coming. Get enough movies in production, and you will be showered in these bonus checks for the rest of your natural life. Running gags. As opposed to callbacks, which are reminders of plot and character moments in Act 1 that are paid off later, running gags are repeating themes, character ticks, or bits that are interspersed throughout a movie or a screenplay. As an audience, our appreciation for these gags grows with each use because we feel smart for remembering them and feel more a part of the story because of it. If a character is set up as liking coffee, then whenever he or she walks into a restaurant and orders coffee, we love it. It's nothing, but we laugh with recognition that we know this character. Running gags can be found in both dramas and comedies as repeating jokes we notice and remember. Note, the running gag must be given a twist later in the film when a character, by now ready to change, goes into a cafe and orders tea. Set piece. A set piece is a standalone action scene or sequence. It stands alone in that it does less to move the plot forward or enhance our idea of who the characters are as it exploits the possibilities of the situation or the premise of a movie. Because of this, set pieces are disposable and interchangeable. A chase scene that takes place on a freeway and does little in itself to move the plot forward can be set in a supermarket, playground, or racetrack. That's a set piece. One that could be dropped or changed within the confines of a studio's slashing of the budget, a director's vision, or a star's dislike of chase scenes on freeways. Six things that need fixing. This is my term, and I use it all the time. It is defined as the list of a hero's minor character flaws, enemies and rivals that bully him, and a wish list that, if we like the hero enough and think he deserves help, get fixed later in the film. I personally find myself going back and forth between Act 1, setup, and Act 2 or 3, payoff, and adding things to the list as I go. We as an audience like to see the six things that need fixing get paid off later in the script. The more the merrier. It's thoroughly enjoyable to see those payoffs, but you have to put the flaw in there in the beginning to make the payoff work. Stakes are raised. This is a term that is frequently heard in development meetings. Also known as the ticking clock or the midpoint bump, it means the raising of the level of tension. Suddenly from out of nowhere at the midpoint, some new thing, an even bigger and more unexpected thing than we've seen before, and one that seems insurmountable, becomes a problem for our hero. You must be sure the stakes are raised at the midpoint to give the hero new challenges and lead him to his ultimate win. Structure. After concept, the single most important quality of a good screenplay is its structure. Very often a producer or executive will applaud the idea, love the writing, and toss out the script because the structure is a mess. They cannot see how the movie is organized, and without that they often don't know what it is. Good structure is one of the several prime components that will help sell your script, and it is the easiest to learn. So learn it. It is part of the language we use to communicate with each other in development meetings, so you must be fluent. Subtext. That part of a scene, sequence, or screenplay that lies beneath the surface, and is in fact its real meaning. The subtext of an argument between a soon-to-be-divorced couple about buying apples is not whether they choose Macintosh or Pink Lady, but the fact that the couple is having problems, and an argument about produce proves it. Do not hit us over the head with what's really going on. It's much more subtle, and better screenwriting to hide the meaning. It's not what they're talking about, it's what they're not talking about that makes these moments so rich. Thematic premise. What is this movie about? Yes, even the silliest monster movie or most spastic comedy has to be about something. If it's not, it's not a good movie. In essence, every good movie is a debate about the pros and the cons of a particular point of view. It is a question raised and answered by the movie. The place to stick that question is up front, loud and clear. It is frequently spoken by a minor character to the hero in the form of a question early on, like on page 5, and sets the debate into motion that will be proven one way or the other in the course of the movie. This question and debate is the movie's thematic premise. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, a.k.a. Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3. Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis describe the thematic progression of the hero's journey. In Act 1, the hero's world is set up. In Act 2, that world is turned on its head. It is the upside-down version of what he left behind. But by mastering this surreal new world, the hero gains the knowledge to combine what was and its opposite to form a synthesis of everything he has learned. That synthesis occurs in Act 3. It is not enough for the hero to survive the journey. He must transform his world in order to truly be great. Tracking. If you have a hot script either on its way out to the town or about to be, odds are it will be tracked by development executives who closely follow its progress. They have even set up an interstudio intranet to talk to each other about scripts and whether or not the script is worth the effort of pursuing for purchase. Based on the concept, track record of the writer, and word of mouth, the script will be considered either hot or not. Sometimes executives will try to outfox each other with misinformation on a hot script, but this sort of maneuver can backfire on them next time. This current tracking system is one of several reasons, mostly economic, that the spec sale frenzy has ended in Hollywood. Tracking scripts in this way cuts down on the chances of any of the studios or their buyers getting burned. Whiff of death. The added extra bonus found in the all is lost point on page 75 of a well-structured screenplay. It is that very special moment where something metaphorically or actually dies. And since this is the place where the mentor bites the big one, the moment when best friends and allies you thought looked sick now kick the bucket, and the spot where spot is removed. This is the perfect place to put such story beats. The all is lost point is rife with the whiff of death because it marks the end of the world as is, and the beginning of a new world the hero will create from this seeming end. Plus or minus. This symbol indicates the emotional change of a good scene. I first heard about this from Robert McKee. He believes that every scene should mark a sea change like this, going from one emotional extreme to another. And he's right. If you think of each scene as a mini-movie, you must have a before snapshot and an after snapshot to show this change. Deciding what the emotional shift in each of your scenes involves is the key element in making that scene a success. When I'm using index cards and my corkboard to work out the structure of a movie, I mark each card with this symbol and make sure I know what the emotional change is in each scene. Greater than, less than. This symbol represents the conflict in each scene. When the scene starts, who has a goal, who's in the way, who wins? These questions can be boiled down into one neat statement using this symbol to denote who's up against whom. Don't start a scene unless you have figured out who your players are and what they want. This recording of Save the Cat, the last book on screenwriting you'll ever need, was presented by Dreamscape Media, LLC. Text copyright 2005 by Blake Snyder. Sound recording copyright 2018, Dreamscape Media, LLC. This recording was produced by arrangement with Michael Wise Productions. Thank you for listening. Please check www.dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.